Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 84, section 7, which is old single column, page 939. We have final couple sections of this paper and of this block of papers. Finish up tonight. They have some final things they want to say in a, in a bit of a bullet point structured sort of a way about the ideals of family life here in section 7. To kind of sum things up, you'll see a number of things that we've read repeated in the process of kind of giving you that summary. But also adding in some additional elements, not all of which are immediately palatable to the present culture. But nonetheless, there they are, and then we'll wrap it up with the bottom line that they want to give us. You know how fundamental marriage and family is to civilization. We've talked about it many times. So probably their bottom line would be to point to an element of the emergency. Why would this foundational element be in a jeopardy it's never been in before? So that's how they'll wrap up. Let's just jump in, see what we've got here.
Section 7, The Ideals of Family Life. Sex mating is instinctive. Children are the natural result, and the family thus automatically comes into existence. As are the families of the race or nation, so is its society. If the families are good, the society is likewise good. The great cultural stability of the Jewish and of the Chinese peoples lies in the strength of their family groups.
How much just from the opening paragraph it's summarizing, like I said. Again, wanting to stress something we were talking about right up to the end, preceding session, that contrast between the natural and the unnatural. Sex mating is instinctive, and all the stuff we've talked about that comes naturally, orbits naturally about that. But the challenge is to begin to bring in unnatural functioning and to do so with ever greater wisdom, insight, and foresight, which doesn't happen automatically, so there's difficulties. But eventually it settles down and a world is settled in light and life. Just one little quick thing to note. Notice that they said if the families are good, the society is likewise good. Just notice that you now know to be more precise when you see the word good. And that's, they're invoking a relationship to the spiritual. Or as I say shorthand, good is a spirit word. So even if that's not necessarily immediate when you consider what they're talking about, they're reminding you that if you're going to have ever more well-composed, coordinated systems of beings, that only happens if the individualities, the persons involved, are ever more in common attunement to the spiritual nature above our minds, spiritual ministries that engage us, and how that potentializes us to have ever greater cosmic expressions. As I point out occasionally, they throw in real, or good, or just. Just always pause and note that there's always that subtle challenge that they're giving you to pause and reflect. It's like, well, how could I think about how, even though it isn't maybe very direct or overt, how could I think about how spiritual was in play? Can I reflect on it and come up with something? They're basically asking you to do that. You know, see, there's nothing directly said there. It's just a passing reference. So it's homework. You know, the relevers are giving you homework when they do something like that. You know, encouraging you to engage it reflectively yourself and see what you can come to recognize. All right, let's keep on.
Woman's instinct to love and care for children conspired to make her the interested party in promoting marriage and primitive family life. Man was only forced into home building by the pressure of the later mores and social conventions. He was slow to take an interest in the establishment of marriage and home because the sex act imposes no biologic consequences upon him.
Again, you know, many ways summarizing, you know, but, you know, often saying things in a slightly different mode, but the same basic point being added. So, you know, they're wanting you to, like I said, they're giving you a series of bullet points that are going to lay all out in front of you, and they want you to think about them synthetically, to weave those all together into a holistic picture and subsequent understanding. Things about there's a maternal instinct, but there's not a paternal instinct. You know, there it is again. And that he was forced, right? I mean, it all has to be an unnatural cultural superimposition, you know, that you submit to, right? That you allow to dictate your behavior. Let's see, anything else there? Just the way they said it, you know, because the sex act imposes no biologic consequences upon him. And we all know how every woman, you know, has at least kind of heard herself say that in her head if she hasn't said it out loud, you know, kind of just saying it to the cosmos, you know, because it's just not fair, like they were talking about before. But it's the way it is. Again, you see how, you know, what we see is initially unfair. What it really is a contrast to Havona. Perfection is not at the beginning. It's at the ending. The more unfair something is to begin with, the more potential it has to eventually manifest something that can't exist in Havona. So just as difficult as it can be to try to set aside the animal origin mind that has issues with the negativity of your experiences, and to give at least some voice to the yes, but there's a future, and there's a God of evolution, and things will ever improve. Initially, by grace, in spite of ourselves, no matter how hopeless men are, like they pointed out, things will improve. They just will be improved by the evolutionary process. You know, and it's fundamentally that will improve. You know, I'm picking on men right now. That will improve men, not some fiat, you know, dictate. I mean, the evolutionary process is what really improves all of us. No matter how much it seems like some person is, you know, laying down the law or something. You know, in the end, it's the evolutionary process that produces genuine, lasting, upheld improvement. Okay?
Sex association is natural, but marriage is social, and has always been regulated by the mores. The mores, religious, moral, and ethical, together with property, pride, and chivalry, stabilize the institutions of marriage and family. Whenever the mores fluctuate, there is fluctuation in the stability of the home marriage institution. Marriage is now passing out of the property stage into the personal era. Formerly, man protected woman because she was his chattel, and she obeyed for the same reason. Regardless of its merits, this system did provide stability. Now, woman is no longer regarded as property, and new mores are emerging designed to stabilize the marriage home institution.
Okay, before we get into that list, just to help, it's probably most people, recognize how the link between the word chattel and cattle, okay? But don't overplay that. I mean, chattel doesn't mean cattle any more than cattle really means cattle, right? I mean, they're two different words that are just referring to movable property, right? In contrast to a house that's glued to the ground. You can move the cow about, okay? That's what that, like they say, just shortly after that, where they, no longer regarded as property, okay? I mean, you aren't making an animal, reference, really. You're just pointing out that it's a type of property, movable property. And notice again, the little challenge that they put in there that I was just making. Regardless of its merits, and of course, you're me, it's like, chattel, I've got issues with that. Yeah, right, definitely relative to Havona, there are issues with that. But, right, this system did provide stability. Where there's stability, there's an evolutionary process in play. You bring things into order, not to bring them into a final position, but to allow them to be evolved forward. Right? Man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. That's what each of you are doing when you supply favorable conditions. So you're not trying to rearrange your mind into some final state. You're trying to put it in order so it can be evolved, so it can be grown. And that's what those favorable conditions are, is a proper potentializing, getting yourself in the game of the evolutionary process, lest you be left behind by it.
Havona to do what time does for animal origin creatures.
Yeah.
Nothing about it.
Yeah, and even if you did know something about the physics of Havona, you couldn't think about somehow applying it out here, if for no other reason the stuff that's out here is dual and the stuff that's in there is triune. Right? It's a totally different physics, not to mention that the whole point is to bring things into existence out here that can't be made by fiat in a domain like the central universe. Okay, the other thing in there, you notice, besides the mores, of all flavors, religious, moral, ethical, together with property, pride, and chivalry. And you're going, well, pride, Chris always talks about how that's a really, really negative word. Well, remember, again, this is a lot of summary. They brought that out a while back. In the context of the fifth epical revelation and what it's challenging us to do, which is to go beyond where we're sort of being progressed unwittingly, and the evolutionary process is working with our often kind of, in an existential sense, existential sense, unfortunate tendencies. It's working with them anyway. All these simple creatures all have a tendency to be prideful, but we can work with that. Well, that the fifth epical revelation is trying to challenge us to go beyond that, where you have a definitiveness of relationship to your child, for instance, that isn't, "I'm proud of you, son," that goes beyond that early primitive stabilizing incentive, you know, where you're basically using the energy of pride to maintain an identification with your child and hence stabilize the family. You know, that works fine in the early phase, but not in the advancing phase of the development of civilization. So eventually you have to, all good things taken to extreme become bad. And even when it's diffused, when pride is diffused, you know, so it isn't so individuated and very problematic, it still is problematic long term. And eventually you have to have a better incentive than that. You know, you have to be engaged to your child for some reason besides pride. You have to be engaged to your, you know, spouse for some reason besides chivalry, you know, or property, or, you know, whatever, right? You know, if pride had no evolutionary validity, it wouldn't exist. Right? You know, you know, and you're going, well, why did God make us so that, you know, we could become prideful and you know, self-destructive? Well, in the early phases, that's how you stabilize marriage, for instance. You know, and then it's up to you to gain the wisdom, insight, and foresight to know when it's time to move on to better incentives.
Well, just a personal experience. In college, I had allowed myself to fall down into a very depressed, dismal state. And it's like grasping for some way to get out of it, and there wasn't much that I believed in at the time, and I finally, it was family pride that forced me to make efforts to get out of that terrible state, because I really didn't have anything else.
Right, you couldn't find anything within yourself, but you could say, well, I can't bring my family to shame.
Right.
So I'm going to reach deep and, you know, I'm going to soldier on. Yeah, see, I mean, it. And remember, it's, actually, it goes beyond kind of merely an incentive, because it's a spirit word, pride, spiritual pride. You know, it's, you know, in a minimal degree, it can be properly called a motive. Right? The pride is a motive. Right, so that you actually have spirit over mind over matter, you know, the full hierarchy in play. But nonetheless, yeah, it's, you know, as Gene was pointing out, it should take just a little bit of reflection for you to appreciate when that's kind of been a key role either from you or to you in holding things together in your life. And it just reminds, like I said, it reminds you again of what a challenge the fifth ethical revelation is. How much it's challenging us to go beyond the way we've approached everything. It's like all the old ways that we motivated ourselves and stabilized ourselves and whatnot. They want us to set all that stuff in the rearview mirror and behold, all things are becoming new. I mean, it's just a huge challenge to try to find. It's like, well, if I don't get up in the morning for that reason, why am I going to get up? Right? If it's not the profit motive, right? I mean, what's the point? You know, or whatever, you know. So.
I feel like a little poverty to strip you of that.
Yeah, just, you know, we have, you know, we just want to always keep in mind, you know, that when I say certain things about, you know, pride is, you know, very, very bad, you know, okay. I mean, I'm speaking in a fifth epical mode. I'm not dismissing that historically, you know, it's significant or something like that. You know, I'm just trying to point out how the revelators are trying to turn us to see if you can construct a sentence that you always use that doesn't use the word proud or pride. And you're going, man, I don't think there's a word in the English language for exactly what I want to say there. Yeah, see, that just shows you. The revelators are challenging us to be a society that's so different from the one we have right now that we haven't even coined the word that's used in that future society yet. Okay? There's a word that has the power of pride that's not the negative word pride that hasn't been coined yet and needs to be coined. Yeah. Okay.
Rhyme with pride?
So now they're going to give us these 4 points. Like I said, it's often kind of literally bullet points that they're giving us. Before we read the first one, just remind yourself and try to hold on to this, what these are about. New mores are emerging designed to stabilize the marriage home institution. Each one of these points is about that issue of stabilizing the marriage home institution. So let's look at number one.
Number one, the new role of religion. The teaching that parental experience is essential. The idea of procreating cosmic citizens. The enlarged understanding of the privilege of procreation. Giving sons to the Father.
Okay. Now, so they're pointing out the obvious there with the little heading. Religion should play a significant role in a new stabilizing influence. And look at that list. Maybe you can argue that there's sort of elements of the third one in some current evolutionary religious pictures, the privilege of procreation, giving sons to the Father. It's like, well, okay, maybe kind of, sort of. But, as they say, an enlarged understanding along that line. Okay. Which only the fifth epical revelation can give you, right? Where you have a better idea of the universal Father that humans have never had, and has a better idea of what you are as a son of that Father. And just why you're using the word son, and why you're using the word father, all the philosophic issues we always talk about with that in the fifth epical revelation. Okay, the other two, that's very definitively fifth epical. The teaching that parental experience is essential, yeah, like you've never imagined. You don't leave Gerasim heading for Adentia until, remember we talked about the other one last time, that male-female super additive consequence experience is the other one, along with parental. So the fifth epical really brings that out definitively, like humans have never imagined. And then the idea of procreating cosmic citizens, welcome to the fifth epical revelation, cosmic citizens. Not spiritual citizens, cosmic citizens. Relationship to the mother and the relationship to the father, both there. Okay, both universal parents. Okay, so so they're saying, you've had shades of this religious element. Use the fifth epical revelation to take that up a notch and make it very definitive. Okay, how about number two?
Number two, the new role of science. Procreation is becoming more and more voluntary, subject to man's control. In ancient times, lack of understanding ensured the appearance of children in the absence of all desire, therefore.
Yeah, especially when you thought that the sex act didn't have anything to do with children. read a while back. Okay, so we had religion on the one hand, here we have science. Okay, now this, see, is very much in play. Post 3 centuries of the Enlightenment, we've got some basic science in play. And so we all know how this works. And the fact that can very much help to stabilize, because there's complexities, and, you know, and this may be a valid desire, you know, that they're talking about there, you know. But in the past, it didn't matter if it was a valid desire. It's like you're going to get kids no matter what, you know. So that just that fact. Now, as I was about to point out in number three, that kind of feeds in to another issue where this can be overplayed, this impersonal science thing. Okay, so let's look at number three.
Number three, the new function of pleasure lures. This introduces a new factor into racial survival. Ancient man exposed undesired children to die. Moderns refused to bear them.
Okay. Now, the big issue with the, you know, the little heading line there, the new function of pleasure lures, of course, that's the final section. That's where we're going to talk about that. You know, see what they're pointing out there. First of all, just, you know, one little quick aside that they give you immediately there. This introduces a new factor into racial survival. Yeah, okay, if no one has kids, that's the last generation. You know, if they're so fixated on individual delights, and like they said in the previous one, it's like, didn't matter how much you wanted to be fixated on individual delights, there was going to be kids anyway, and you're going to be grounded by the fact, and et cetera. Now you can just totally eliminate the problem, you know. And, you know, and they're pointing out, see, now, at the same time, as we've gone forward, you know, we're much more tender people than ancient man they're referring to there. I mean, we all know how difficult it would be for humans in general to just expose their undesired children to die. You know, we still have issues with infanticide. You know, the ancients didn't. Irrelevant. Okay, but if you can use science to make it totally out of sight, out of mind, ignorance is bliss, and just abort the child, you know, and basically no physical consequences to it because you have very sophisticated science and whatnot. Okay. Okay. Now you're going, okay, I can see some potential issues here. Yeah. So, you know, it doesn't take me to do much unpacking there. You should be able to follow that line to its problematic conclusions. Yep.
So John Hay is asking, are these new roles suggestions of things we can do to get the revelation out of your lab and into the hearts and minds of others?
Well, definitely, you know, like I pointed out with number one, which isn't in play the way it could be without the fifth epical revelation enlightenment, you know, there's definitely a much that could be done there to really challenge so-called science, which is just philosophic materialism, you know, in so many ways. Which just thinks of us as blobs of protoplasm. It's like, no, we're not just blobs of protoplasm, right? Matter of fact, so much, you know, it's so much the case that we aren't just blobs of protoplasm that they really aren't your children. They're God's children, right? Why do we call it procreation, right? Because we know we're not creators. The creators are just working through us. You know, so just remind yourself of that logically. Oh, I'm not the source, right? The source is going through me. They're not really my children, right? They're the universal mothers and the universal father's children. Okay. You know, that would be a great thing that we could, you know, work on getting out and challenging that, you know, that utterly devalued, depurposed, nihilistic, you know, first principle, the Lucifer Manifesto sort of mentality that comes from science, you know, when it, so-called science, when it's just, you know, assumes that all there is matter and that the universe is purposeless. You know?
It's not directly related, but indirectly. We kind of have a picture of an ideal family. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's promoted in advertising and whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, right now, it's usually two parents and two children, mm-hmm. one of each sex.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's the ideal family.
Right, the bumper sticker family, okay. Yes.
Three families, three kids, oh, well, that's good. You know, mm-hmm. Four, five, six. Mm-hmm. Now it's getting mm-hmm. problematic. It's like our ideals of an ideal family is really changed over the
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Very much over our lifetimes, this has radically changed, and before we leave it behind, you know, notice that it isn't all just a harsh negative fact. As negative, in some, you know, especially in some existential sense, when you know they aren't really your children, you know, that the fact of abortion is. Right, is complicated as item number one makes item number three, okay? I'll remind you, there's new mores are emerging designed to stabilize the marriage home institution, right? You know, in a transitional difficult stage, for a short span of time, a pleasure lure actually can help to stabilize things a little bit, so maybe you can get to a more enlightened culture. See, so they aren't, you know, see, they aren't absolutizing this, and don't take anything that I've said, you know, here in the last few minutes as some sort of an absolutizing, existentializing of this, you know. Just like birth control, you know, in the number two sense can help stabilize things. You know, they're pointing out, okay, it's kind of primitive, yeah, but it, abortion does stabilize a difficult state of affairs a little bit. But, you know, you should, you know, you notice which item is, you know, number one and which is number three, okay? And we should be stabilizing things with something besides something as crude as abortion. You know, we got to be able to dig deeper, you know, than just reworked infanticide. Okay, number four.
Number four, the enhancement of parental instinct. Each generation now tends to eliminate from the reproductive stream of the race those individuals in whom parental instinct is insufficiently strong to ensure the procreation of children, the prospective parents of the next generation.
Okay, so that just happens once you loosen up the mores a little bit and people actually have the option of not having kids and don't have kids. The positive side of that in the evolutionary process is, remember, we tell you, they mentioned just a little bit ago again, that, you know, you have a very strong maternal instinct, you have no paternal instinct, but we mentioned there is a weak parental instinct in both the male and the female. And it's like, well, is it supposed to be forever weak? No, the evolutionary process is supposed to strengthen it. When eventually those who don't have, have a relatively weaker parental instinct act upon that because of science and don't have kids, ta-da, they don't pass that genetics on, you know. And over time, the parental instinct becomes stronger and stronger and stronger. Okay. All those people that think they're saving the world because they're not going to have children and contribute to overpopulation. It's like what they're really doing is guaranteeing that future people will definitely have children. Yeah. See, that's what they're really doing. And they're part of the evolutionary process. Right. It's a vast conspiracy. Planets, you know, don't get to light and life, you know, because of how profound we are to begin with, right? It's all a vast conspiracy that gets us there. So there's that parental instinct. You can look to the future. And I often bring it up, a normal world in the post-Bastol Sun Age, that they tell you we can't even remotely imagine what that world is like, how people think, what their culture is like. You can't even remotely imagine how strong the parental instinct is on those worlds. It would just seem utterly, bizarre to us that anyone would be as identified to their children as they are. Okay. All right. So those are four things. See, some of them we can, especially like number one, we can play a very conscious role in. Some of them, no one has to be really thinking at all about what they're really up to. It's just going to happen, and it's going to stabilize things and improve the situation. So there's a whole spectrum there of something you could put on your to-do list and things that just, you don't have to put on any to-do list. It'll just play out naturally. Okay. Something else?
Sorry. So John's asking, however, it seems that those of higher genetics are those choosing not to have children.
Right.
Versus those of perhaps lesser genetics.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we obviously know that, because when we have these options and we don't have the requisite wisdom, insight, and foresight, we make unfortunate decisions. But again, Most High is ruling the kingdoms of men, and everything else that goes with that, and they tell you point blank, they're working on conserving the better types, and if we are so hopelessly self-destructive, they'll see to it that coincidentally, right, there is at least a thread that goes forward, and can, you might have a long dark time when the handful of people that have any significant genetics are sort of cloistered away, hidden away somewhere on the planet, where they're out of sight and out of mind of the hordes, but they'll reflower civilization from that seed at some point, if that's the way it has to go. Yep.
I think they mentioned throughout the book that, particularly in Jesus, when they talk about the apostles, and they make a point about how individualistic every one of them was,
Mm-hmm.
And I think, isn't this part of the deal, too, that the higher genetic types there's more individual choice involved.
Sure.
So they're going to be more particular.
Yeah.
They're going to experiment more. There's going to be more trial and error, and they're and more broken off stuff, because they get to a point, they said, maybe it's not.
Everyone has to trust the process, right? The more personal it becomes, the more it's a double-edged sword, right? And people are going, that's a destructive choice, that's unfortunate, but choice there must be, it's not just us, but all the celestials all have to trust that, we have to be very individualized, and, that can lead to short-term problems, but in the long run, it'll play out, either because the fix is kind of already in the system, and it's kind of hidden, it's really there, the solution is already really there, and it'll play out. Or if someone needs to intervene in a father-like fashion, that's what the very father-like beings, the Verandadex, are for. They'll insert themselves in, and make sure that something critical isn't lost. It'll all play out as it needs to.
Save us from the collapse of civilization?
Again, only if that's required.
It seems like it's required because of the genetic thing. Yeah. How the higher genetics had one or two kids. and the rest are having 4, 5, 6.
Again, you know, we can speculate. You know, you can make cases both ways. You know, if you're honest with yourself, you know, like I said, you can make an argument both ways. It's like, well, I don't know. You know, what if there's something in the third super universe that requires this planet to go through an interregnum? Yeah, I mean, how do I know? You know, yeah.
I wish you did know.
Yeah, I know. We all wish we knew. I mean, the author of this paper, right, the primary supernifem, wishes he knew, but he doesn't.
Yeah.
And he was created by the third person directly on the Isle of Paradise, for Pete's sake. You know?
We just don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, we just don't know.
Okay,
we all humbly have to just trust that it'll play out, like I said, as it needs to.
It's playing out all right.
I was thinking about the other day about the frog that hadn't leaped.
Right. Hadn't left.
But
yeah.
They had several in the waiting.
Right.
So in that case, I would think the Most High wouldn't act. But if this was, they tell us in the book, there are going to be no more Adamic strains to the planet.
Again,
so they're kind of giving you, it's like, you know, they may, you know, if we don't come up with a way ourselves, you know.
Right. Again, isn't it comforting to know that, you know, that our hopelessness, you know, our ignorance is not the final word? You know, if someone has to intervene, despite all of the wisdom that's inherent in the evolutionary system, you know, and sort of just this quote-unquote natural mode, someone will, and it'll be fine. An emergency sun will be activated. You know, the Most High Observer will assume a regency or whatever the heck has to be done. The trumpet blast will happen. The divine executioner will do something drastic. Whatever has to happen will happen. You know, and we'll get the light in life.
And who's to say that we can judge what's intervention and what isn't?
Yeah.
Could the intervention happening right now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oblivious to it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that whole statement about, you know, they're intervening to conserve the higher spiritual types, right? I mean, that's, but even, you know, the creative mother spirit telling her angels, you know, to let things play out, you know, in a negative fashion more freely, that's an intervention.
Yeah.
You're saying, well, now naturally, people would, you know, might not be able to play, you know, their sin to its fullest. Intervene and make sure they can play it to its fullest so that we can get this out of the system as quickly as possible.
Maximum expression,
listen. Yes. Unlimited opportunity for sin expression. Yes.
That's pretty direct.
Yeah, so,
plus they give it.
See, that's the thing, you know, like they tell you many times, oh, I wish, you know, when you're thinking, man, I wish they would intervene, be careful what you ask for. Intervention isn't always sunshine and lollipops. okay. When your angel or your adjuster intervenes in your life, what do they tell you about that? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking a speed bump that tears out the transmission, okay? Yeah.
Honey, what's the tow truck's number?
Okay, let's keep going here.
Let the home as an institution, a partnership between one man and one woman, dates more specifically from the days of Dalmatia, about 500,000 years ago. The monogamous practices of Andon and his immediate descendants having been abandoned long before. Family life, however, was not much to boast of before the days of the Noddites and the later Adamites. Adam and Eve exerted a lasting influence on all mankind. For the first time in the history of the world, men and women were observed working side by side in the garden. The Edenic ideal, the whole family as gardeners, was a new idea on your ranch.
Coincidentally, the next paragraph is about interventionary influences. Weren't we just talking about that? See, so yeah, you can already see what the point is. I don't have to explain it. We already teed it up. Like I said, they're summarizing, you know, an awful lot here. We've talked about that before. But they're reminding you of that little element, like we were just reminding ourselves of that interventionary wild card. And you know, and again, how back to that, to get anywhere with marriage and family, you've got to get beyond the natural, the merely natural. You know, and whether it happens through basically an evolutionary process or a little bit of tweaking by the hand of the descended hand of the father intervening, in the sons of the capital S sons of the earth, one way or another, it gets into a more and more of a chosen, unnatural mode that it has to be in if it's going to be anything profound. Okay.
The early family embraced a related working group, including the slaves, all living in one dwelling. Marriage and family life have not always been identical, but have of necessity been closely associated. Woman always wanted the individual family, and eventually she had her way.
Not by the force of her will, though, like I've been saying, but the evolutionary process validates her early opinion, right? You slosh around, and eventually, it works better this way to not have, every Tom, Dick, and Harry all living under the same roof. Yeah, let's make it more of a nuclear family. Let's not live in a big lodge, or whatever. Okay, and that it happens naturally. And again, it's like, well, where did that insight of hers come from? That was sort of validated eventually through the evolutionary process. The maternal instinct, right? The hand that rocks the cradle still fraternizes with destiny. There's a little bit. See, she had a little inkling of the destiny right from the beginning. And eventually, that came to pass. All right.
Love of offspring is almost universal and is of distinct survival value. The ancients always sacrificed the mother's interest for the welfare of the child. An Eskimo mother even yet licks her baby in lieu of washing. But primitive mothers only nourished and cared for their children when very young. Like the animals, they discarded them as soon as they grew up. Enduring and continuous human associations have never been founded on biologic affection alone. The animals love their children. Man, civilized man, loves his children's children. The higher the civilization, the greater the joy of parents in the children's advancement and success. Thus, the new and higher realization of name pride comes into existence.
There's Gene's name pride coming into play. All right, and he was just...
saved a wretch like me.
Saved a wretch like me, yes, right? There it is again. Okay, they're bringing in a few little details, like licking babies clean and stuff here. And you go, wow, that's just like animals do it. Yeah, and I see they're reminding you that again of how, if you're going to get to anything sophisticated, you got to go beyond the natural pretty early on in some instances. But just, when all is said and done, remind yourself of something there. Think about how strong of a quote-unquote, love or affection you have for a grown-up child of yours. And remind yourself that that's not natural. You've imposed that upon yourself, or society has brought that into play. You aren't doing that instinctually, that you still feel so close to your 30, 40, 50-year-old child or whatever. It's like that. You mean jealousy is not biologic? See, it's like that one. To challenge you, just how much you are influenced by your environment. And you think you're not. You think it's something innate. No, it's not. That's nurture, not nature, that gets you to behave that way. Without any awareness on your part, you've been nurtured into that state, where you feel very, very strongly about your child long after, they may have even still been literally booted out of the home. Nonetheless, and remember, how animal-like the Andonites were, like we've talked about. They could, it's not that they didn't have any, affection for their grandchildren. No, it's worse than that. they couldn't even conceive of grandchildren. It was just too abstract a concept. You know, you're like, well, how is that possible? I mean, can't they? Well, it's just look at, they're giving you a little reminder. You know, if very early on you kind of boot the kid out, you lose all causal linkage that those other kids came from your kids. Yeah. You know, it just, they aren't looking at big picture. They're very down in the, in the trenches of life. And
that's why so many, so much warring.
What was that?
That's why so much warring.
Yeah.
Ensues.
Right, you know, right, yep.
Because they're not connected to them.
No one has any big picture connectivity. I mean, almost, like they're pointing out, almost instantly, this kid is going to be like a foreigner in your mind, you know? So out of sight, out of mind. So it you can see how many of these points are again, just stressing between the lines. You're looking for something quite unnatural to have something profound here. Okay? Just, read the whole list, too, with it.
The large families among ancient peoples were not necessarily affectional. Many children were desired because, one, they were valuable as laborers. Two, they were old age insurance. Three, daughters were saleable. Four, family pride required extension of name. Five, sons afforded protection and defense. Six, ghost fear produced a dread of being alone. Seven, certain religions required offspring.
So notice right at the end there, see, that, like I pointed out with number one in the previous list, there has long been religious elements that have inserted themselves into the marriage family phenomenon. I'll give you an example of number seven in the next paragraph I'll read in a second here. But just, lest you get yourself all disgusted by daughters were saleable. Yeah, well, look at the boys. The boys were cannon fodder. Yeah. The daughter might have been sold, but at least she's still alive. Yeah. The son is dead because he's cannon fodder. Go die for the family, son. Yeah, yes, sir.
Well, the whole list is a little bit funny.
Yes.
I'm glad it wasn't me.
But again, all of this had its internal consistency and stability. Yeah, and so why are they giving you this whole list? Because, if you're going to go to a better system, quote-unquote better system, you can't just think about one element. It's like, all we have to do is just make it so that daughters aren't saleable anymore, and we're finished. It's improved. No, it's a whole system. You got to work through all the different elements and get an improved system, not just an improved part.
And most of these aren't that far in the rear view mirror.
No. With people living longer so that dementia can set in, the old age insurance thing is becoming very definitive again. Where suddenly children are having to take their parents in and actually kind of become parents to this addled biologic parent.
That's where death panels come in.
And we've got, so it's, yeah. But that's just, I want to just see, don't get, before you try to burrow into the science of a particular bullet point, always ask yourself, philosophically, why is this list in the book? Why did they just burn that much real estate in the book for this list? What's the philosophic point, right, that's running through that? That's always the first thing you need to get in your head before you burrow down into the, analytically down into the details. Otherwise, you're not working relative to the truth in the revelation. You're going to put those bullet points into your pre-existent framework and not the revelatory framework, and you're going to run with all of them erroneously, not truthfully. That's very important to pause and try to see if you can get some inklings of the why question. Why is this list in the book? You know, and there's always more than one answer to that, because it's kind of infinitely deep, you know, the why of it all. But at least get some initial, you know, plumb the depths a little bit, right, before you start running with the analytic engine. Okay, what's this little example of number 7 they give us here?
Ancestor worshippers view the failure to have sons as the supreme calamity for all time and eternity. They desire above all else to have sons to officiate in the post-mortem feasts, to offer the required sacrifices for the ghost's progress through spirit land.
So, yeah, you can't send all the sons out to die as cannon fodder. You got to save a few of them to officiate your transition to spirit land. Other than that, they're not really good for anything. Okay, but see, again, you know, they're all, you know, like Terry was saying, you kind of chuckle over a number of these items. But again, just appreciate how there's a system here. As simplistic and superstitious as it might be, it's a system, and it all holds together, and the society all agrees to it, and everything's stable and working. So when you start to get rid of some of those things because science sets aside a superstition, well, you've just broken the whole system, you know, and everything's going to start to unravel. You're going to have to step in and try to get a hold of the whole thing systematically, or the next thing you know, it's just going to be a pile of debris all around you. Okay, what else do they say here?
Among ancient savages, discipline of children was begun very early, and the child early realized that disobedience meant failure or even death, just as it did to the animals. It is civilization's protection of the child from the natural consequences of foolish conduct that contributes so much to modern insubordination.
Okay, there's a biting little one, right? It's not like only, you know, recent children have a tendency to disobedience. Okay, that tendency's always been there. Okay, but they were sobered really quick back in the old days, you know, when their brother died. That put the fear of God in their heads, you know, as it were. You know, sobered them up quick. Think about how Seth was sobered up just like this when Abel died. All right, totally changed his life. Like, whoa. Okay, And he let go of the delights of the moment and stuff, and really challenged himself to try to take a big picture and try to, you know, be an influence going forward as a Sethite priesthood, to help mankind not to lose sight of the big picture. Okay. And you get the material comfort era when things are cushy. You can make all sorts of blunders and you don't die. Well, that's problematic. Because the next thing you know, you just, nothing sobers anyone up anymore. And you just have insubordination, and eventually, civilization-wise, you have anarchy.
Mm-hmm. Failure, yeah. Or death. It doesn't have to be all
of it. Right, it doesn't have to be all of it. Yeah, but, you know, death is a technique. you know, failure sometimes is enough of a, you know, whap upside the head, but it's often not enough.
Action, consequence.
Right. And again, right there, you got it. See, what's the key thing philosophically that's going on there? In getting individuals to engage the first cosmic intuition and approach life knowing that there is a thing called causality and facts. There are facts that are just facts, and cause and effect. And it doesn't matter what you want. It's just cause and effect. That's the way it is. You face that. Common sense. Yeah. They're just pointing out how a child, you know, in this kind of crude way, primed the pump of their common sense, their relationship to the first cosmic intuition back in the day. It was really rugged. And, you know, it became very obvious very quickly that you needed to listen to exactly what your parents are saying. Because if you deviate one iota, you're dead. If they say, be quiet, you be quiet. Or whatever.
That's important. That first cosmic intuition, if you don't have that, you can still engage the second and third, but it won't be in a healthy way.
No.
You'll tend to mysticism and magic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, the extreme is engaging the third cosmic intuition without the balance of the first, that leads inexorably to fanaticism. And that scientific consciousness, that rudimentary scientific consciousness of the first cosmic intuition is what stabilizes your mind so it doesn't fly off into fanaticism when you engage that very energetic juicing of your mind that is brought into influence from the third cosmic intuition. You don't get, in genuine enthusiasm, an in-godding of your mind, if you will, right? Remember that godlikeness is on the sixth level of meaning. You don't get that. You get fanaticism instead. So philosophically, that's between the lines with this paragraph, like I'm pointing out. How do you get children grounded? Well, it was the harsh sorts of things like the four indispensables in the early phase, those cattle prod like things. Sober you up quick. Okay, here, got Eskimos again.
Eskimo children thrive on so little discipline and correction simply because they are naturally docile little animals. The children of both the red and the yellow men are almost equally tractable. But in races containing Andite inheritance, children are not so placid. These more imaginative and adventurous youths require more training and discipline. Modern problems of child culture are rendered increasingly difficult by 1. The large degree of race mixture, 2. Artificial and superficial education, 3. Inability of the child to gain culture by imitating parents. The parents are absent from the family picture so much of the time.
Okay, so they want to give us a little bit more on this theme they started with insubordination of children. They're reminding you of just how much Andonite blood are in the Eskimos. Remember, they're not just Andonite. There's Blue Man in there, and of course, eventually Red Man gets in there too in very recent times. But the counter is, but just primary Sangic doesn't change it much either, right? They're very place-like when you're favoring one of the first six adjutants. You know, you're one of the six Sangic races. You bring in directionality when you bring in violet race. So that little child is not this thing that you can just, place on the floor and then go wash the dishes anymore. You turn your back for a second and you've got issues. Then they bring in a little bit of detail there, it's even more problematic than what you're amping up with Andite blood if it has cross purposes things from, random, or sort of unregulated race mixing like has happened because of the default. And then you bring in the issues like, artificial and superficial education, where, you know, you go, well, wait a minute, I thought artificial, you know, unnatural was an important thing. Well, yeah, all good things taken to extreme become bad, right? You know, we have so much of our educational process now has gone way off into abstraction. There's no grounding, you know, in the basic natural state of affairs. That's the what they mean by artificial there. And, of course, the superficial, you know, it has no depth of insight to it. It's completely shallow. You know, and so it doesn't serve you well at all when the going gets tough. Yeah, so that, you know, and, you know, I bring that up all the time. I mean, just, you know, how, you know, universities are just completely almost lost in this regard now. You know, it's very, very sad. And then the whole issue of, well, what if everyone has to, you know, work so that, you know, you're farming out the kids? Well, then you've got number three there in play. It's like, well, you know, they can get influences from others. It's like, yeah, but it's not the same. You know, just one little fact to consider there that you only know from the fifth epical revelation. You know, even, you know, you don't even get any hint of it from psychologists, really, you know, yet. Until roughly age 16, your biologic children are mindily connected to you. You know, you have a subtle influence on them, you know, that way that, you know, what you do in the outer life, you know, you might say with them, gets kind of backed up and reinforced by your literal energetic connection to them. It's almost like that energetic connection is subtly holding them so that you can engage them more effectively than just, you know, random person can. They're in your place. So you're innately the most effective as the biologic parents. Okay, what else do they give us here?
The olden ideas of family discipline were biologic, growing out of the realization that parents were creators of the child's being. The advancing ideals of family life are leading to the concept that bringing a child into the world, instead of conferring certain parental rights, entails the supreme responsibility of human existence.
Ah, see, now they're playing off item number one there back in that first list. You're not really your children. You're not really the creator. See, you know, but like I said before, everyone's thinking, oh, we're the creators of the child's being. No, not really. You know, and how that shifts everything. You know, they're giving you examples. Like, well, okay, you got that basic point. What does that imply? Well, here they're giving you an example. Well, that implies, you know, that you need to think differently about parental rights. Instead of thinking of rights, you know, yet another quote-unquote right that you have, you know, which is really just the mores system sort of made quasi-existentialized, you know, when you use that word right. You know, it's a responsibility, not a right. You know, and how that turns everything 180 degrees. Okay, what else do they say?
Civilization regards the parents as assuming all duties, the child as having all the rights. Respect of the child for his parents arises not in the knowledge of the obligation implied in parental procreation, but naturally grows as a result of the care, training, and affection which are lovingly displayed in assisting the child to win the battle of life. The true parent is engaged in a continuous service ministry which the wise child comes to recognize and appreciate.
Eventually. Right? So you see, you know, the more sophisticated civilization gets, the less things are sort of anchored in very simple direct linkages. It's more of a system, and the child has to sort of get aware of the whole system and kind of get their mind wrapped around the wholeness of it, and then in that wholeness they come to, as they're saying there, recognize and appreciate. It's like, oh, I get it. See, the more there really is a big picture to the civilization, and it's not just a bunch of parts rattling about, you have more and more subtle, indirect, essential elements to the society. So you have to be very patient and not be trying to achieve something in the moment. You have to, think about it long term. It's like, you're guiding it towards an eventual realization. See, that eventually of an evolutionary process, not some instant fiat completion. Yep.
Well, our limited genetics really makes this a slow go.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's so obvious because, like, if you couldn't hear on the webinar, Gene is saying our limited genetics is obviously going to make this a slow go. Like I was saying earlier, a number of these things, like, oh boy, this is going to rattle around for a while, and there is going to be some, oh, that's a little unfortunate, and oops, and you have to, trust that eventually it'll all work out as it should. But if you try to judge it in the moment, it's like, oh, no, this is not going anywhere we want to go. We need to intervene in a very fiat fashion. There needs to be change without growth right now. No, that's not going to get you the goodness you desire. That's going to get you evil. And so you have to be patient and trust that even though it looks like everything's going to hell in a handbasket, it isn't really. But the wisdom to know where the balance is. It's not like you just totally lay back and let it happen. You have to act too. You have to be engaged. But wow, like they're pointing out in that paragraph about it is civilization's protection of the child from the natural consequences of foolish conduct that contributes so much to modern insubordination. See, there's a balance there. It's not like you don't intervene. You have to try to figure out wisely. It's like, no, just let him fall on his face here. No, I'm going to intervene there. And what's the proper balance? That's an important role that the husband, the father has in helping to temper the mother's maternal instinct there. The mother has an instinct to intervene in everything and never allow a single scraped knee. And the father will often it's like, no, let him fall off his bike or whatever. And it's like, but he could get hurt. I'm projecting forward and it's not going to be cataclysmic. Let it play out. So there's some instinct that comes in there. But, they're encouraging both of us to have a bigger picture sense and not just have to be balanced against each other because of our blind spots, that we have instinctually, or our positive tendencies instinctually. All right, let's keep going here.
In the present industrial and urban era, the marriage institution is evolving along new economic lines. Family life has become more and more costly, while children, who used to be an asset, have become economic liabilities. But the security of civilization itself still rests on the growing willingness of one generation to invest in the welfare of the next and future generations. And any attempt to shift parental responsibility to state or church will prove suicidal to the welfare and advancement of civilization.
I think I'll leave most of that paragraph, to the obvious. I have to, hold up that final statement. Just notice how many people in recent times have gotten unfortunate thoughts otherwise, right? You know, that, oh, no, no, not only should there be some attempt, there should be all attempts to shift parental responsibility to, you know, especially to state, you know, in the current secular age. No. That will prove suicidal to the welfare and advancement of civilization. Again, like I was stressing earlier, there is no substitute for that energetic intimacy and influencing potential of parent to child. If you farm that off, you're severing that natural, you know, you can say, well, why is a child mindily connected until roughly age 16? Well, that's kind of what we're talking about. Because if they weren't, there wouldn't be any difference, you know, like they're talking about here. Like, well, let's just farm them off to the state.
What does it mean to do that, though?
Yeah, you know, the village will raise them.
What do you mean the state? Like, how?
Just society will raise them, right?
Social services.
Yeah.
You know, take the child,
right?
Parent.
Not, you know, it takes a family. See, that's what they're trying to remind you. No, it takes a family. There is no substitute. Right? The society, you know, no matter how structured it is by the state, is not going to do the job. Okay? And you go, well, why? Well, again, like I said, there's no escaping that the state, especially when you say it that way, the state, you know, but even just society, that's not a personal engagement to the child. Right? That's why it's suicidal. You're short-circuiting the personal and, you know, engagement. You know, this is a deep mystery, remember. We've never been able to answer the question, why is it that the reflectivity mechanism is not adequate when you know it's so incredibly intimate that we can't even imagine how intimate it is, but instead you have to send a personal being, a solitary messenger, from point A to point B. And we've never been able, because, see, we don't understand this at all. That seems ridiculous. It's like, well, no, just call them up. You know, why do you have to send Bob across the light years?
Don't send Bob.
Yeah. and it's just, you know, there's something very profound, again, about this, even if it's super conscious, this personal engagement that is possible just automatically because of the mindal commonality, the mindal linkage. There's an influence that we're supposed to just recognize, even though we can't understand the physics of, is indispensable. And if you short-circuit it, then all is lost. Because the universe is personality managed. It doesn't manage itself. An impersonal state won't manage it.
Disturbing trend.
Yeah.
Free care is like ubiquitous.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
A lot of short circuits.
Yeah, there's just so many things. See, it's like, well, I have to. Yeah, they're pointing out these economic issues. See, we need to change how this works. Yeah. You know, because it's just these economic things are destroying. You know, basically, what you're destroying is the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Which is how you can have democracy, representative government, and stuff. Right.
And that's been one of the main things, is to assault the middle class.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah, and right. And see, that's when you go to, you know, they remind you, last time you went into the Dark Ages, right, it's because you didn't have a middle class, mm-hmm. You know, and it went to, you had lords and serfs, you had a feudal system. It's going, we're getting a feudal system again. Yeah, you suppose, you know, the revelators know what they're talking about? Yeah, we're on the verge of an interregnum because the middle class is disappearing. You know, and it's, like I've pointed out, there's lots of reasons for that, why the middle-class family is evaporating. But, you know, they're reminding you right here, the most important element is economics. Economics is a science. And science is predicated on philosophy. And if you don't have philosophy, you don't have any science. In particular, that one. It's just going to be ideology, arbitrary ideology, nothing but falsehood, no truth to the science of economics, because it has no philosophic predicate. It's not being challenged to be true, just definitive. All right? So that's the issue.
You have Lucifer declaring 200,000 years ago the equality of mind and being bold and persistent about it. I mean, one family or one person's as good as another. Mm-hmm. We're all the same.
Right.
You know, we ignore racial differences. We ignore the past. We ignore, you know, we impose this, this sameness on everybody. And then in case you forget that, you have Lucifer and Caligastia and Dalagastia and Satan, you know, reinforce that.
Yeah, yeah.
So
right. All of those flattening and, you know, anarchistic, you know, concepts, right? Right. Chris, yep.
Economics.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling that doesn't have to do with money sometimes.
Right. Again, I always remind you, you know, yeah, fundamentally, remind yourself what the word means. It's the laws of the house.
Laws of the house.
Right? There's a lot more than money to the laws of the house.
Well, what does the laws of the house mean?
Yeah, see, that's right. See, it's, you know, you have a whole system. There, you know, it's the laws that, you know, the basic laws that govern the functioning of this physical system of our society. How is it linked, you know, together? You know, I mean, you know, money is just a way of associating two individuals in a certain, you know, mode. I hand you a dollar bill, you hand me a knickknack, you know, whatever. It's an exchange, it's part of that exchange. See, there's the laws of the house. You know, technically, how do we, you know, connect ourselves together? We can all connect together because we're all children of God. Okay, that's all fine and dandy, but it has to get down to a science at some point. No, specifically, technically, how does all these linkages set up? What are the laws of the house? You know, whether it's literally that nuclear family's house, or a more generalized sense of the house, right? Like the economics of Havona, the house of Havona, you know, or the house of the United States, or the house of the world, or whatever, you know. What are the laws of the house? What are these technical, scientific modalities of how we engage ourselves materially, interact with our, you know, between us, ourselves materially?
Like when, remember, I said houses and you did this. Is that what you're talking about? You said, like, one time I said territorial states, and I said it's like a house or something, and you said this connection?
Yeah, I mean, it just, you know, when you say house, you know, think about when you do a little simple drawing of a house. Okay, you make these two walls, and then you put this little tent-shaped roof on the top of it, right? You know, there's an umbrella, right? You know, that's over, say, okay, everything within this sphere is a certain domain, right? It's, you know, it's just, you know, how you're delineating a group of interconnected phenomena. Right? They're all under this umbrella. Mm-hmm. All right. Chris? Oh, so something?
Yeah. Another question.
Mm-hmm.
While the middle class is losing ground in the U.S., it is gaining greatly in the developing nations on a relative scale. Does this have a deeper connotation?
The leading edge of civilization is having a positive impact on the third world, if you want to call it that. developing nations, developing countries, you know, they may not be nations yet really, but developing countries. But again, if you take the light for that phenomenon away, are they going to generate it themselves? No. See, I mean, that's the thing. If the light goes dark in the leading edge of civilization, you know, those non-self-initiating parts of the world are not going to self-initiate. You know, they do it, you know, because, you know, we might literally encourage them along those lines, or they just are picking it up, parroting.
Yeah, they're copying.
Right?
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, again, you know, they just mentioned that. You know, inability of the child to gain culture by imitating parents. The parents are absent from the family picture so much of the time. Okay, just take that out of the family and put it to the big picture like we're talking about. The exact same physics is in play. The leading edge of civilization are the parents, right? And the developing or not yet developed parts of the children. You take the parental influence away and you think the children are going to self-initiate, you know, self-actualize? No. Especially when you're talking, you know, about, like they also mentioned, the Sangic Andite thing. Okay? You take the Andite influence away, do you think that the place like Sangics are going to self-directionize? No. Yeah. Okay.
Marriage with children and consequent family life is stimulative of the highest potentials in human nature and simultaneously provides the ideal avenue for the expression of these quickened attributes of mortal personality. The family provides for the biologic perpetuation of the human species. The home is the natural social arena wherein the ethics of blood brotherhood may be grasped by the growing children. The family is the fundamental unit of fraternity in which parents and children learn those lessons of patience, altruism, tolerance, and forbearance, which are so essential to the realization of brotherhood among all men.
Okay, again, I'll let most of that just stand as a straightforward the punchline at the end. Those of you who've been around me for a while should go, well, wait a minute, I recognize some of those words. Patience, altruism, tolerance, forbearance. That's four of the six. Four of the six what? Four of the six facets of cosmic character. Right? Right? So they're reminding you there indirectly that if this is going to be something significant going forward, it has to have cosmic character. And that cosmic character begins in the inner life of individuals. And the fruits of that inner life flow out into the external world of the society. Right? So they're just highlighting some of those. And remember how all of those are predicated on patience. Patience is the nuclear element of all the facets of cosmic character.
Well, what are the other two?
Fortitude and forgiveness. Each of them, you know, have what's on the third level of meaning as a nucleus. You know, it might be you might literally express it as patience, like forbearance is patient restraint. Okay, another way of thinking about that third level of meaning, like with altruism, that's self-neutral. Mercy. Right? Remember how you know initially the arrows are all pointing in, and then you get to the third level and it's neutral, you know, and then the arrows are pointing out as you go above that. See that self neutrality, you know, combined with mercy to give you altruism, or the temperance that is there on the third level of meaning. Tolerance is tempered zeal. Each of them say, why do I give patience as one of the first handful of favorable conditions to focus on? Because it's the nuclear element for the, you know, the bigger things.
Right? It's a foundation.
Right, it's a very foundational element. You can't get to the cosmos, you know, you can picture it directly in the hourglass analogy. Right? You relate to the cosmos in the upper domain, not the lower domain. You can't get to the upper domain except through the neck, the level of patience. Right? It's obviously the nuclear element for everything above.
So would altruism be the first step above that level of patience into the upper?
No, that's two steps up. That, you know, it's self-neutral mercy. So, you know, and don't think of it on the levels, because you've gone beyond the levels. What you do to make those facets is you move up all the levels, and then you grab that ladder, if you will, and you lift it up, picture it horizontal, and wrap it around into a circle, you know, where it becomes a six facets of cosmic character. You know, it's all those are transcendent of the levels of meaning. But they're predicated on them, you know. It's, you know, like patience, of course, is just, you know, the fullness of that cosmic patience is just level three brought up. You know, altruism is three combined with five brought up. Tolerance is three combined with two brought up. Forgiveness is patient love. Right? It's three combined with six, et cetera. You know, again, you can always go to that little handout on the facets of cosmic character and check that out.
The thought adjuster operates is it doesn't ignore the egoistic motive, but places a slight emphasis on the altruistic motive is leading to happiness.
Right, right. See that? Yeah. You know, remember, just mercy itself is you know, that level of selflessness. Right. See, in contrast to the egoistic, right, the self, you know, centered picture. Right. So, altruism is just taking it. You know, mercy is self specific. I'm going to be merciful relative to that individual. You know, if you make it, you know, regardless of specific individual, then it's altruism, otherism, not just that specific other, but all others, and, you know, the literalness of the word altruism is otherism. Okay, let's keep going here.
Human society would be greatly improved if the civilized races would more generally return to the family council practices of the Andites. They did not maintain the patriarchal or autocratic form of family government. They were very brotherly and associative, freely and frankly discussing every proposal and regulation of a family nature. They were ideally fraternal in all their family government. In an ideal family, filial and parental affection are both augmented by fraternal devotion.
Okay, so they're just kind of pointing out, we were just talking about the levels of meaning, the fourth level, level of kindness, the level of kin-likeness, level of brotherly love, fraternal devotion. Right, they're just pointing out the obvious that, you know, that's the basic glue and modality of a family. How could it be anything else but kin likeness? And you know, and they're pointing out, we saw that we went from mother family to father family, and that was a positive step, they said, in many ways. Yeah, but all good things taken to extreme become bad. You can overplay patriarchy, like they're pointing out here. You know, if it goes completely autocratic and arbitrary, right? You know, direction, but, you know, within a system, not as if direction, you know, is an island universe and doesn't have to give any consideration to other issues, and just drags everything along, you know. No, it needs to be harmonized in a system. And if it isn't, you've taken it over the line, that patriarchy. Okay, so they're just pointing again how much that that more big picture mindedness of the Andites naturally didn't overplay patriarchy. And what else do they say here?
Family life is the progenitor of true morality, the ancestor of the consciousness of loyalty to duty. The enforced associations of family life stabilize personality and stimulate its growth through the compulsion of necessitous adjustment to other and diverse personalities. But even more, a true family, a good family, reveals to the parental procreators the attitude of the Creator to his children, while at the same time such true parents portray to their children the first of a long series of ascending disclosures of the love of the paradise parent of all universe children.
So, well, for the bottom line on this summary, you know, they're reminding you of how this is the beginning of, you know, this is the introduction to that whole hierarchy of mothers and hierarchy of fathers. You know, maybe a couple things. Notice, you know, just kind of the little qualifiers or additions they threw in there. A true family, a good family. You know, we talked about good early on when they brought up that, you know, so they're just, you know, making sure you think about the fullness of it. You know, there's that relationship to the spiritual spark, a good family, you know, and it's in the context of the whole, a true family. And then at the beginning there, true morality. You know, remember, when you finally transcend the mores, you know, the bottom-up mores system concept of what morality is about, and see it genuinely top-down, as the revelators are trying to get us to take that step, you know, to take that next step. Your moral duty is your duty to the cosmos. See, and, you know, notice how they bring up the ancestor of the consciousness of loyalty to duty. Right? See, morality is a duty still, but it's a duty to the cosmos. As an individual, no other individuals involved, just you and the cosmos. You as a part need to be synchronized with the whole. And having taken that step, okay, now we'll figure out the more complicated thing about relating to some other individual. And boy, I hope they've taken that first step, because that'll help. If we have the common predicate of the cosmos to work with. You know, and genuine ethics, you know, has morality as an inescapable, you know, genuine morality is an inescapable predicate. And I mean, you can't really get to ethics if you don't get to morality.
That morality identification with the cosmos, or how did you put it again?
Duty to the cosmos.
Duty to the cosmos.
Yeah.
Could that be that larger, you know, the extent of your frame of thinking, that outermost frame that is the most holistic and can grab? And I think they're trying to develop like a supreme.
Yeah, yeah. If you
frame of thinking here.
Yeah, it definitely. If you want to think literally about how what that duty to the cosmos.
115, section 1. They talk about the frame of thinking.
Right. See, I mean, that's the whole point. How do you literalize your duty to the cosmos? You know, it's by having that framework of your mind reflect the cosmos, reflect the universal harmony. That's the predicate of everything that goes on inside of your mind. Right. It has that cosmic predicate, you know, and that means you're a moral being in the Urantibuk, full Urantibuk sense of that word moral.
Kind of the widest wrapper of your mind,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
That you can get your mind, that's what allows you to get your, wrap your mind around something.
Yeah, right, yeah. You know, and to have that, when you do wrap your mind around something, you do that truthfully. Because see, you can create a false framework.
Yeah, and people, so many people, they look at that and they say, "Oh, you know, one person's frame of thinking is as good as another." You know, and long-time readers too, because they've kind of given up on the
Yeah, and see, and if you end up with moral relativism, if you fail to recognize that the proper definition of morality is top down and not bottom up. If you think of everything bottom up, it's like, well, yeah, it does seem to be just, well, there's Bob's and there's Betty's and there's James's and, you know, whatever, you know. I mean, yeah, everyone has their own notion about the moray system, right? See, and remember how that works, like we've often talked about. You can take that moray system and bring it in and lift it up and make it that framework. You know, supplant the initial tenuous framework that was given to you by grace at roughly age 6 when you're encircled in the Holy Spirit. Right? You know, and then conformity to that framework, which you think of then as the cosmos, see, is your morality. But that didn't come from down from above. You brought that in from outside and stuffed it up there. You know, so it's a morality, but a false one, you know, in the fullest cosmic sense. It's not a true morality. It's not conformity to the genuine cosmos.
And that's how your conscience, they say that in the thought adjuster papers, they make a distinction. And it could, and again, it's very subtle because they don't want you to go flying off on a tangent with your thought adjuster. But the conscience, you know, isn't necessarily God talking to you. Because so much of it is the mores.
Yeah, right. Right, because again, right, that's what conscience is. You know, when you drag that stuff, put it up there, you know, you'll have this voice coming down from above through the neck of the hourglass down into your where your ears are below, and you know, it will appear to be coming from beyond you, and it must be right the voice of God, but it's not. You're the author of that voice. You drug it in from the external world and shoved it up there, and it now speaks to you from afar, because you're not familiar with that. That's you up there. You know, you think that upper domain is outside of you, right? You don't recognize that unconsciously you have been using your personality to reconstruct things up there. You've replaced the third cosmic intuition with religious dogma. You've replaced the second cosmic intuition with social usage.
You interpret it
yeah.
before you recognize it,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and then, you know, I don't want to belabor this because we're running out of time here, but you know, remind yourself of, fundamentally why there's an emergency. It's not because humans are merely, you know, messing things up with the second and third cosmic intuitions, with the moral discrimination and the spiritual insight, you know, replacing them with social usage and religious dogma. Humans have always been doing that, and there hasn't been an emergency. The emergency is when you lose the foundational leg of that three-legged stool. When you supplant your common sense, what you get with the first cosmic intuition, what they mentioned in what we just read, how important that was to get the child spun up relative to that, you know. If you supplant the first cosmic intuition with scientific dictation, and think about that in a very first cosmic intuition rudimentary sense, if someone else tells you what's a fact, instead of you independently recognizing what's a fact, then we're lost. Okay? And you can see how you can see the emergency all around you every single day if you watch the news, right? That this is happening, that scientific dictation, supplanting independent exercise of the first cosmic intuition in individuals. Because what's, you know, in that paragraph, what's the pair, you know, what's paired with scientific dictation? Remember, you have scientific dictation, social usage, religious dogma, you know, and they have slave to that religious dogma. You have a social automaton. Okay, but what kind of a behavior do you manifest if someone else has told you fact? What's a fact? Intellectual parrot. Okay. Just listen to the news, you know, when every single talking head repeats the same word or phrase.
Every
Right? That's because they're no longer in control of fact. They've surrendered that. And someone else is telling them what's a fact. And of course, you know, the frustrating thing is it never is this so-called fact. Okay? It's scientific dictation.
Independent recognition.
Right. Okay. That so you can just see it happening. Right? Just how common it is for everyone to use the same word or the same expression. That's that intellectual parrot. And that's the emergency.
And Chris,
the fact that that can happen.
That's dropping down from the seventh adjutant to the fifth
adjutant. There isn't someone that breaks that chain. You go, someone says, no, I'm not going to repeat that because that's, no. See, there's no courageous and independent cosmic thinking. You know, there can't be because there's no foundation for it. See, you've surrendered the whole upper domain. You're a total helpless victim now of antecedent causation. If the established authority says something, then it is in your mind. End of story.
Put the jackboots on.
Okay, you got something?
Yeah, back to the family for just a moment. John's asking, is this the reason why we all have to experience raising children? We learn by loving our children how God loves us without measure as we love our kids?
I didn't emphasize that, but I should have. Notice how poetic some of this gets towards the end of this section. There's some sweeping passages that are trying to remind you just how important this is and why it would be one of these indispensable elements in your ascension career. If you don't get it here, you have to get it one way or another. Because there's a certain beauty and refinement of character that cannot be achieved any other way, period. And they're trying to stress that. Okay, let's get this final section. So here it is, bum, bum, bum. The emergency.
Section 8, dangers of self-gratification. The great threat against family life is the menacing rising tide of self-gratification, the modern pleasure mania. The prime incentive to marriage used to be economic. Sex attraction was secondary. Marriage, founded on self-maintenance, led to self-perpetuation and concomitantly provided one of the most desirable forms of self-gratification. It is the only institution of human society which embraces all three of the great incentives for living.
So they're still doing this, this summary thing. It's like, wait a minute, that sounds really familiar. They've basically said that before. Okay, so they are starting us off again in this section with that little reminder of how, how this could be such a foundational element that it sort of just naturally encompasses all three of the great incentives for living. So that's step one. And all of the kind of naturalness of the cosmos subtly, in spite of ourselves being a dominating influence, you can short-circuit that by using your personality to will your mind apart from the cosmos, right, and have it all just be about you and your pleasure. Yeah. That's what they're getting at there. Again, it's in that motive. There's a danger if you're not synchronized with the cosmos, because that means you're not upheld. And the specifics of danger, that dominate. Naturally, the cosmos dominates the upper domain in the hourglass analogy. Right? It's superimposed upon it. But you are sovereign up there. You can wall the cosmos off. and put yourself at the ceiling. Okay, so that exalted self becomes the dominant top-down influence. Okay, and that's what the word danger means. Okay?
Originally, property was the basic institution of self-maintenance, while marriage functioned as the unique institution of self-perpetuation. Although food satisfaction, play, and humor, along with periodic sex indulgence, were means of self-gratification, it remains a fact that the evolving mores have failed to build any distinct institution of self-gratification. And it is due to this failure to evolve specialized techniques of pleasurable enjoyment that all human institutions are so completely shot through with this pleasure pursuit. Property accumulation is becoming an instrument for augmenting all forms of self-gratification, while marriage is often viewed only as a means of pleasure. And this overindulgence, this widely spread pleasure mania, now constitutes the greatest threat that has ever been leveled at the social evolutionary institution of family life, the home.
Right, and the only reason this is happening is because we're more spiritual now. We're more personal now. We can be more self-blinding now. We can take a hold of the upper domain more than we could before. Right, but we're not doing it creatively. We're doing it destructively. First to ourselves and then to the whole civilization that's predicated on us as individuals. You know, so just, you know, notice the kind of intriguing way that they help you to, you know, appreciate that. You may not have ever dissected it like this before. Property accumulation is becoming an instrument for augmenting all forms of self-gratification. And I see, oh yeah, property is not just some pragmatic issue. It's starting to become this falsely exalted, you know, thing. It's like where you, you know, get all excited about the fact that you have this object, right? Yeah.
This problem is married to technology these days.
Mm-hmm.
And well, they must have foreseen that that would happen.
Yeah.
But they don't mention it.
I mean, why are you supposed to buy the latest iPhone? Because it's some practical issue? No. No, it's got even better self-gratification, you know, apps. Yeah. Everything is driven by, you know, you have no idea the pleasure you'll, you know, experience if you get the new one. You have surround sound pleasure now or whatever, right? You know, it comes with, you know, artificial reality goggles or, you know, whatever the heck, you know. Just so you can you can cut yourself off from everything, and it's just all about you and your pleasures, gratifying the self. You can make a lot of money off of self-gratification.
Yeah, for a while.
Right? You know, in these days. Yeah. So, you know, it's not the fault of the companies that are making a lot of money off of this. You know, if we weren't so fixated on this, they wouldn't be making money off of this.
It's not a self-sustaining technology.
Yeah, right. And it's obviously because it has no, you know, it isn't grounded in some bigger practical system. It's doomed to collapse at some point, right? As it just becomes more and more artificial. It's like, you mean the glove box in your car doesn't keep your beer cold? I mean, how do you even live? Right?
Maybe.
I mean, you have to actually turn your wipers on? I mean, how primitive. I mean, you know.
It's where the andite drops down and maybe got more into the blue man. You know?
Right. Just,
you know, yeah, well, player for the back seat. What are you talking about?
Right. Right. I mean, you know, we remember we saw that with, you know, in that first list of 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, how the science in number two led to number three. It's like, well, okay, we're overplaying the science thing. Now it's becoming self-destructive. And it's driven by the pleasure mania, see, mm-hmm. like they pointed out. You know, technology just ceases to be about, improving, the efficiency of the outer life. It all just becomes about this closed off pleasure phenomenon.
Well, you said, Chris, what did Niels Bohr say a century ago about, you quoted it sometime, he said he thought his theories went this way because they just, felt good to him.
Right. Yeah. See, even science at the beginning of the 20th century lost its philosophic connection. It's like, well, where does the initial assumptions come from? Well, you pick the pleasing initial assumption. Oh, well, that's going to go well for science then. See, again, even pleasure mania has taken over science, right? You don't, there is no such thing as insight for you to have figure out how to predicate your line of reasoning. You just, pick the one that strikes you as pleasant. That's the appropriate initial assumption. And then everything is a delight afterwards. It's all a pleasure mania phenomenon now. Even science.
What do you suppose healthy gratifications look like in the context of
how
off we are?
I wanted to know that too.
Yeah. I mean, that paragraph is pregnant with the question. It's like, well, what would a proper self-gratification institution look like?
Do you have any ideas on
that? No, let's see. There's a reason why it hasn't happened yet. This is quite obtuse. But see, we can't do it here. Like I always say, that's getting into the science of it, right? There needs to be we need to have a science of this. We need to think this out and figure out something that is a proper outlet.
The neighboring planet seems to be enlivened with just how systematic they are about, maintaining and improving civilization.
Now, when you get to the quest for knowledge and wisdom, right, and everyone is fundamentally driven, the most pleasing thing that I can imagine achieving is for my thinking to be higher quality tomorrow than it is today.
Right.
There's a productive outlet for your pleasure pursuit.
Uh-huh.
Quality of thinking.
They're on the vertical.
See, you've got issues, with when you're in the material comfort area and all you really can be incentivized by is quantity and not quality. That's kind of the main reason why it hasn't naturally evolved those institutions.
Junk culture.
Okay, let's keep going here. We're going to end up being kind of late here if we don't keep going.
The violet race introduced a new and only imperfectly realized characteristic into the experience of humankind, the play instinct coupled with the sense of humor. It was there in measure in the Sangiks and Andonites, but the Adamic strain elevated this primitive propensity into the potential of pleasure, a new and glorified form of self-gratification. The basic type of self-gratification, aside from appeasing hunger, is sex gratification. And this form of sensual pleasure was enormously heightened by the blending of the Sangiks and the Andites.
Okay, so again, just see that amping up of the minds by the infusion of Andite blood, and just the way they italicize potential of pleasure. The potential of pleasure. I often talk about how can you go beyond just sort of being driven by the actualities in front of you? Can you start to really be driven by the recognition of potentialities? Well, that's a double-edged sword, again. Because, it could be, think of the potentials of self-gratification, as opposed to, think of the potentials of civilizational advancement. Does that recognition of potential get all stuck with the self? That's what they're getting at, just by italicizing that, just how, you know, you can imagine pleasure now. You don't have to just stumble upon and go, oh, that was pleasing. Wonder where that came from. You know, you can sit there and imagine, ooh, I could,
oh, yeah.
I wonder if I did that. You know, and of course they bring in this, you know, you set the hunger aside and you got the next hunger in line, sex hunger, and, right? And ooh, what about that? You know, we all know how that has gone over the centuries. Okay, well, what else do I have to say here?
There is real danger in the combination of restlessness, curiosity, adventure, and pleasure abandon characteristic of the post-Sandite races. The hunger of the soul cannot be satisfied with physical pleasures. The love of home and children is not augmented by the unwise pursuit of pleasure. Though you exhaust the resources of art, color, sound, rhythm, music, and adornment of person, you cannot hope thereby to elevate the soul or to nourish the spirit. Vanity and fashion cannot minister to home building and child culture. Pride and rivalry are powerless to enhance the survival qualities of succeeding generations.
See how pride is coming up short?
Yeah.
They're telling you, like I was saying earlier on. Okay, all of the definitiveness of that paragraph, you know, we could talk for an hour, but let me just, you know, point out the most audacious thing that's said in there. Again, like I was saying up front, this, the fifth epical revelation so blows up what everyone has always believed about things. I mean, look at that statement. Though you exhaust the resources of art, color, sound, rhythm, music, and adornment of person, you cannot hope thereby to elevate the soul or to nourish the spirit. How many people think that's true? No. That's how I find my soulfulness or my spiritual, enhancement is through music, for instance. Nothing does it like music. Now, what are they saying there? No, it doesn't do it one iota. What? You sure it doesn't just do it a little bit? No. You cannot hope thereby to elevate the soul or to nourish the spirit. See, none of that stuff, that's feelings. You're calling fancy feelings spirit. I mean, that is so horrendous, you know, a statement. I mean, it blows, relative to the current beliefs. Like I've said so many times, run with the consequences of that one statement. How many assumptions everyone is living by are just shattered by that. All of the satisfaction of so-called soul and spirit that they just blew up there. They just ripped away from you.
Yeah.
Again, this is not, it reminds you of how, okay, maybe not everyone should have that ripped away from them quite yet. That's pretty harsh. Yeah.
In fact, there's inspiration, and they talk about the musician who could change the whole society. So
yeah.
It doesn't directly elevate the soul as an individual, I think.
Right.
But obviously, there's some truth to.
Yeah, see, see, what, right? See, how do you put together what you're recognizing is true, and what I'm just emphasizing here? Mm-hmm. See, again, it's that whole soul spirit thing. You don't get to that bottom up, no matter how much you pump it from the bottom up and how fancy it is. Mm-hmm. No, you get that by taking hold of what reached down to you by grace. You don't build your way up to that, okay? The crescendo in the music doesn't lift you up to that.
Until we reach the higher ground.
Okay? You have to just choose to turn it 180 degrees and to take a hold of that. And if you do, like Terry was just saying, then you become this top-down phenomenon that can flow out to the world like that musician they speak of in the Celestial Artisan paper that will transform the world. Yeah.
If you don't think for yourself, there's no way.
Combine that with any other discipline you want to talk about, whether it's art or whether it's whatever. All the expressions would be augmented by this method.
Right. You see that? Just recognizing it, it's like, no, it's nothing that is done to you. Because it's about the domain where you're sovereign. No one, including the universal Father, can do anything there, really. It's about you choosing. It's in your hands.
It's not going to work to wear golden
robes. Yeah, or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
The incense wasn't right.
So, yeah, anyway, I've made my point. What else do I have to say here?
Advancing celestial beings all enjoy rest in the ministry of the reversion directors. All efforts to obtain wholesome diversion and to engage in uplifting play are sound. Refreshing sleep, rest, recreation, and all pastimes which prevent the boredom of monotony are worthwhile. Competitive games, storytelling, and even the taste of good food may serve as forms of self-gratification. When you use salt to savor food, pause to consider that, for almost a million years, man could obtain salt only by dipping his food in ashes.
And you go, well, why do they throw in that last thing? Well, because they're trying, you know, as you're reading this, you know, initially you're thinking, oh, I've got to reject all of these things that we think of as, you know, pleasurable because they're evil. No, you're overplaying it. You know, because if you think like that, you're going to actually start dipping your food in, you know, in ashes again, you know, lest you be, you know, sucked into pleasure mania, you know, and be accused of, you know, of Epicureanism, okay, or something, right? Saying, no. Okay, you don't have to put on a hair shirt, you know, go out in the desert like John the Baptist, okay? That's not the answer. So that's why they threw in that paragraph. Because, you know, like we always say, as soon as you, the revelators know it too, as soon as you say something definitive, everyone interprets it as a dichotomy. Right. It's like, no, it's not a dichotomy.
Pleasure's
okay.
Not the problem, the
mania. Right, it's what you're doing with pleasure that's the problem, you know, not pleasure. Okay, so let's get the final paragraph here.
Let man enjoy himself. Let the human race find pleasure in 1,001 ways. Let evolutionary mankind explore all forms of legitimate self-gratification, the fruits of the long upward biologic struggle. Man has well earned some of his present day joys and pleasures. But look you well to the goal of destiny. Pleasures are indeed suicidal if they succeed in destroying property, which has become the institution of self-maintenance. And self-gratifications have indeed cost a fatal price if they bring about the collapse of marriage, the decadence of family life, and the destruction of the home. Man's supreme evolutionary acquirement and civilization's only hope of survival. Presented by the Chief of Seraphim stationed on your rancho.
So, pretty straightforward. Again, is marriage, family, the home, the foundational fact? Yes. Right? And not only that, but it's not only foundational, but it has reached up to the ceiling of the finite, man's supreme evolutionary acquirement, and civilization's only hope of survival. Okay, there isn't any other issue that's more critical, right? It's it. I mean, that's what has to be focused on. Families are the foundation, you know, and if people in government are putting anything else first, they're fools. Right? They're an enemy of the very civilization that they took an oath to uphold. Yeah, that's what they're getting at there. So, you know, when we talk about it's like, well, what can I do? What can I do? You know, how can I save the world? Okay? Starts with your family. Starts with your family. That's how you save the world. Save your family. You know, it's the only hope. You know, nothing else, no redistribution or anything else is going to do it. There's only one thing that's going to prevent this collapse of civilization in a long, hard interregnum. And that's the reinforcement of marriage and family in the home. Okay. That's the bottom line when all is said and done. Like I said, it's about the emergency. It's about focusing on what's the key issue. Once you have your hair on fire a little bit about how there's a civilizational emergency, a philosophic emergency, and you're saying, well, what should I do? That's the answer. Something that's bite-sized. Something that you actually can address. All right. So we move into a whole new block of papers. Next time, we have the evolution of religion. I'm going to go through that whole long, curious process of what initially is sparked into existence by the sixth adjutant. Oh, so many curious things have been called religion. We're going to go through that process and try to separate out where we've been from where we are trying to go and with the encouragement of the revelation. All right.
Such a dovetail and such a plan.
Yeah. All right. Let's take a moment here, everyone.